America, we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. By honoring your career calling, you impact your family, your friends, and your community. The pursuit to serve others is yours. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
Have you heard you can listen to your favorite news podcasts ad-free? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free and catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Let's start off with the House Oversight and Reform Committee. They have launched an investigation into the ongoing baby formula scandal. There are four companies, four companies control 90% of the baby formula market in this country. Four companies. That's it. Four. Abbott, Breckitt, Bensecker, Nestle. I thought they did hot chocolate and water. And Perrigo. Those are the heavy four. One of them have a bacteria problem, so shut down. Trying to get some of the regulations. Those regulations. Hey, what's a couple of dead kids? Got to get past those regulations. Now, the chairwoman, Carolyn Mitaloni, who we've had on the program a couple of times over the years, and Illinois Representative Raj Krishnamoorthy, they are the ones leading this. They wrote a letter to the Big Four, said that the national formula shortage poses a threat to the health and economic security of infants and families and communities throughout the country, particularly those with less income who have historically experienced health inequities, including food insecurity. Now, personally, this is one of those moments where you go, business model of on-demand supply, just-in-time inventory, we just keep right where we're going. Now, they're asking, what steps can we make? And this is where you go, this is the kind of offer where you go, how much money can we give you to lower the price and prevent gouging and help consumers? Instead of, going in with what I would think would be an iron fist, going, don't screw with us. Start pumping up the production there, guys, or we're going to really take a look into your operation and really comb through. Maybe start locking some folks up, because I think this is where we have to start looking. At some point, you've got to go after these big companies and hold them accountable. Where's the Harry Truman of this generation? The worst boss on Capitol Hill was announced today. Congressional staffers look at the representatives and they choose the worst boss, a representative who honestly I've never heard of. Her name, Victoria Spartz, a Republican from Indiana. Had not heard of her, had to look her up. Named worst boss on Capitol Hill. And her statement, I get it. Worst boss. Yeah. She said a lot of these young people need to toughen up. Exactly the kind of boss you want to work for. You people, you and your poverty wages, you showing up to events so you can get the crackers and cheese. It's crazy. And, you know, today I tweeted out a story about Elon Musk because everybody seems to be on the right, just all tingling in the panties over Elon and how wonderful. Oh, he's going to buy Twitter and he's going to let us say mean things to people we hate. Isn't he wonderful? You know, there's the woman on the airplane who was, you know, basically doing the whole, you know, Chevy Chase praise Marty Moose thing. You know, praise Elon. And you go, what are you talking about? They're throwing you off the plane for being an idiot. But evidently, you know, the SpaceX and Tesla CEO, Elon did an interview with the Financial Times folks where he praised Chinese workers. And this is one of those things where you go, it's not like these Chinese workers have much of a choice in what you're praising them for. He went on this spiel about how, you know, there are a lot of super talented, hard-working people in China who strongly believe in manufacturing, and how they don't just burn the midnight oil, they'll burn the 3 a.m. oil, and they won't leave the factory. This is a direct quote. They won't even leave the factory type of thing, whereas in America, people are trying to avoid going to work at all. And, you know, this is one of those frames where you go, they don't have a choice. In fact, if you listen to the Chinese workers and some of the organizing that went on, has been going on for a while, they've been fighting back against the 996 culture. And you go, what's a 996? Is that like Herman Cain's 999 plan? No, it's not like that at all. This is 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. workdays, 6 days a week. That's 996. 9 a.m., 9 p.m., 6 days a week. You go, but that's a lot of hours. Yeah, that's a lot of hours. That's 72 of them a week. That's to make just a bare existence. And yeah, Americans aren't going to do that for poverty wages and desperate conditions. No, we're not. And we shouldn't have to. But understand, our benevolent dictator, and understand, benevolent dictators are still dictators. But the Elons of the world, that's what they want for working people. And I keep saying, this is where we're heading back to, because in this country, that's how it was. And if you listen to the Elon Musks and the CEO class of this world, that's what they pine for. They pine for a desperate workforce. You know, pliable and compliant, desperate, poverty-ridden, people who have to show up, you know, and work sun up to sun down like it used to be in this country, 6 days a week, just to make a meager existence. And this is where we have to, as working people, have these conversations on what kind of an economy do we want to have. And we're in a moment. We are in a moment where we're right back in the heart of the Gilded Age. In 100 years, when they look back at this, as we look back to the Gilded Age of, you know, 100 years ago, they're going to go, how did we make the same mistakes that we knew about? How did we allow it to happen again? And why didn't we do enough to stop this kind of mass inequality where you've literally got somebody who's worth, you know, what, a couple hundred billion dollars? Mind you, a couple hundred billion dollars that a good portion of it came from taxpayer money. You know, this idea that Musk, you know, self-made man, no, started off, you know, parents owned a diamond mine. A diamond mine, man. This is not a guy who started off on a street corner with a tin cup selling pencils. This is not somebody who whittled his bootstraps out of intestinal fortitude. This is a guy who started off on third base, says he hits a triple. Telling working people that, well, you know, those Chinese workers, they know how to work. Oh, boy. They don't burn the midnight oil. They burn the 3 a.m. oil. It's because they don't have a choice. You know, when Foxconn was having people jumping to their death in the stairwells to get out of going to work so that they could get out of it. We can't take it anymore. What did Foxconn do there? Did they make conditions better? No, they just put nets in the stairwells. Catch those people, get them back to work. And you got to ask yourself, is this the kind of economy we want? And the answer is no. We have workers who are organizing every day. You look at Starbucks. Again, today, three more landslide victories at Starbucks in California. And look, these are workers who are, you know, hardworking folks, low-wage jobs, saying we've had enough. We've had enough of a multinational, multi-billion dollar corporation profiting off of our backs. We want some of it. We want dignity. We want respect. And it's not just the low-wage workers. You've got Intel engineers who are, you know, mounting union drive campaigns. There was this one guy, he's running for Congress, mounting a union drive at the Oregon chip factory. You know, this idea that it's just all about, you know, poverty, about low wage workers. It's not. It's about all up and down the scale, as it should be. Now, a listener sent me an email with the talking points that Apple put out to their store people, to their managers. And I would have to imagine the managers got the message, because this is what Amazon did to their management people. If people organize, you're going to get fired. So these talking points come with, these are our talking points, and you better use them or you're probably going to find yourself on the curb. But they're the kind of talking points where you just go, you know, the world that they're trying to create doesn't have to be this adversarial kind of situation. You know, like one of the talking points, you know, Apple's a place where our connections with and our care for our teams creates a special culture. Everyone has an important role. Yeah, that didn't seem to matter yesterday. That didn't seem to matter before the union organizing campaign came along. Our team comes from a wide array of backgrounds, they write, and have different aspirations and needs. Direct relationships we have with our team allows us to understand and celebrate our individual differences. You know, pushing that individualism that has been screwing us for so long. We often say people come here to do their life's best work. We want to give everyone the space to do that, but that requires getting to know you personally. It requires us as leaders to understand your goals and where we can provide you with the best opportunities to grow. It also takes, you know, which is why we put such emphasis on building individual relationships. You get the sense here that they really don't want people standing with each other. They've used individual and direct relationships with the person. They've used this a lot. I've only read a paragraph. Because like any flock, it's easier to take out, when you can get the sheep separated, it's easy to get one of them. And then the next one, and then the next one. They go on, Apple is a place where our connections with and our care for our teams creates a special culture. Everyone has an important role to play. If a union were to come into the store, well, we would be placing many of our interactions in the hands of a third party. We could lose some of our ability to engage directly with, you know, blank on many issues. You go, why? Why would you do any different? Why would you talk to people differently? Oh, that's because you want it differently. I got it. Okay. They go on to say how things could change. You may be hearing about union activities at a few of our stores. I want to touch base if you have questions and let you know if you have thoughts. Every one of us has different reasons for coming to Apple, and we look to hire people who want to do their life's best work. People we hire are talented, interesting, and bring perspectives and aspirations to the job. These are their talking points. This is rambling. So if there was ever a union campaign here, I want you to know that we could, well, write to support a union or not support a union. It would be your choice, but we want you to make an educated decision. they go on to talk about, you know, we want to make the store great. What makes a store great is having a team that works together. Like so much about relationships, if we're going to work well together, we've got to help each other. Know if someone's under stress, know if someone has needs in some space and the ability to talk through and work out problems. That's what unions do. They work through problems, they talk through problems, and they solve them. And you know what else they do? They get them in writing, and they solve the problems in writing so that they have contracts, so that you don't have to keep doing it all the time. Pretty simple. Now, they say that can't always happen when a union represents a store's team members. And a union would speak for you on most issues related to work. Maybe you'd agree with the union's approach, or maybe you wouldn't. There's no way to predict. Now, understand, unions are democracy in the workplace. When you and your co-workers come together and you decide on a path forward, that's the path you move forward on. Now, they go into a whole bunch of other, your basic attack, points. And it's focused on the hyper-individual. You know, you might lose something. You might not get what you want. And the reality is they're hoping to divide and conquer. They're hoping that they're hoping to create an environment of adversity. Because the reality is, in unionized workplaces, problems get solved because people sit down and actually negotiate on somewhat equal footing. And this is the important part of this. And that's what they don't want. They don't want that equal footing. They want the we've got an open door policy. You can come in and, we can dismiss you. You can't dismiss a group of union workers. When empowered workers walk into the boss's office and demand change. And one of the things they talk about is the point system they used to have. You know, we used to have a really rigid system. And then, a whole bunch of people came to us and said, we want change, and we change things. Yeah, that's what a union does. See, it works. You just showed us that it works when people come together and negotiate collectively. Congratulations. Church of Collective Bargaining just worked. And this is one of their talking points. I don't know what Walmart union busting firm they got. I don't know what low rent union busters wrote these, but not great. Apple Store, do better. I mean, that's all I can come up with. Or don't. And hopefully the workers there will organize. Just my thoughts. I'd love to hear yours. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. But it's really kind of comical in a way. In that you've got all of this money that's going into attacking workers and their want of a voice. And I go back to something my grandfather always said, and it always sticks with me in these moments. If a rich guy's going to take a buck out of his pocket to tell you you don't need something, you better spend two to get it. Because what they understand is return on investment. If Apple or Amazon or Starbucks or XYZ Corporation is spending money on union busters to tell you don't need that union, you can negotiate for yourself. You can do it. Maybe I'm double thinking. Maybe I'm going, I better have this. And me personally, I'm spending the $2 to get it. Back after this.
If you're a fan of the show, you've heard our Labor History in 2 segments, and you can hear them on the radio pretty much anywhere in the U.S. Labor history has never been more important than it is right now. So here's what we'd like you to do. Tell a teacher. Tell a teacher that labor history is important and that they can get digestible 2-minute lessons that are absolutely free. Free to download, free to use, free to share. Tell a teacher to go to thericksmithshow.com/history and help us put labor back where it belongs, in the classroom. Generations of American workers fought, bled, and died to build the American way of life. It's our job to keep their stories alive. Go tell a teacher that we're here to help them do just that. Find us at thericksmithshow.com/history today.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So there's an article in Politico today that grabbed my attention as Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Senators Elizabeth Warren and Raphael Warnock are pushing the president to do something on student debt. And this is one of those things where there's a heavy push on Biden to do something. And I keep coming back to, I still think the absolute right answer is to buy up all the student loan debt, have people pay it back at the amount that they borrowed at 0.5% interest and be done with it. So the talking points can go like this. They borrowed money, they paid it back. That simple. No one got anything more than anyone else got. So past generations who are whining and complaining, I didn't get, my student loans forgiven, have nothing to complain about. People who didn't go to college because, hey, the amount of money was too much. There's nothing there for them to complain about. They still had to pay it back. But it's done a little bit fairer. And on a certain level, there has to be some fairness put back into this system. And then going forward, and this is where legislation matters, we've got to fix our higher education system. We've got to begin to claw back a system that works for all working people. You look at the skyrocketing costs of tuition. And there are a bunch of reasons for that. Massive tax cuts for corporate America, massive sums of money being stripped from higher ed. When 2011, when Tom Corbett was governor in my state of Pennsylvania, he proposed a 50% cut to higher education. And I think he ended up with somewhere around 25 or 30% ultimately. They gutted $1 billion from education as a whole that year. And this is one of those moments where we've got to go back and undo the damage of the tax cut fetish. Because the tax cuts never got down to working people. The tax cuts never made its way to the people who show up and punch the clock every day. It went to these big corporations who are doing what? Oh, yeah, they're buying back their stock. I mean, this is a major anger moment for me. Because if you remember, we were told if we just give the smart people all the money, they'll know what to do with it. They'll use it in the most productive way possible. They're going to invest in new business. They're going to invest in new technology. They're going to invest in better tools for workers. Your productivity is going to go up. The country GDP will expand. It's going to be great. All of the economic voodoo that they shoved down our throats. And these stock buybacks are telling us one thing. All of that was bull. Or to use a Biden term, all of it was malarkey. What it really was a giant ripoff. It was a con. And sadly, we working people continue to buy that. And the weird thing is, and this is where I reach out to my conservative Republican friends, my Trump voter friends, even they get it. When you strip aside which team you're on, when you take off your red cap or your blue cap or whatever T-shirt you're wearing that day, whatever team you're on, whatever flag you've staked in the ground, when you actually just talk about the policy stuff, even they agree. They get it. We've given way too much power to corporate America. We've given too much wealth to the wealth class. We've created a billionaire class out of whole cloth because we completely gutted our tax code. And that's how we used to pay for education. That's how we used to pay for infrastructure. That's how we used to pay for a future. It's how we invested in the future of this country, and we gave it away. Much like our manufacturing, much like our productive capacity that we could have used to get us out of this moment where our supply chains are jammed up. This wouldn't have happened 30 years ago, 40 years ago, because we weren't depending on China or someone else. We were depending on ourselves. That was policy. Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. If you just joined.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I gotta tell you, I love this story about Marjorie Taylor Greene. Evidently calling up some woman in her 70s, a lifelong Republican in her 70s, and, you know, admonishing her for spreading vicious lies. Went on this whole rant about, it's been brought to my attention that you're spreading some lies about me. That are being spread by one of the leaders of Antifa. Someone that you wouldn't want to be involved with. Basically telling this woman in her 70s, you better check yourself. You go, wait a second, what are you going to do, Marjorie? You going to go over there and smack her around a bit? And then I thought about it. I'm like, yeah, probably. Yeah, I mean, these people are that kind of, that level of crazy. And they're going to possibly take control in November. Let the fun begin. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on just how crazy things could get and where the top stories of the week have taken us, I've asked our good friend Max Burns to come talk with us. Max is a Democratic strategist, columnist over at the Daily Beast, and the newest on-camera correspondent with the Young Turks Network. Max, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with that. Congrats on the Young Turks gig. Good job for you.
Thank you very much. I always will take any opportunity to tell more stories about how Republicans are undermining democracy. It seems important, you know?
It does. Now, I'm looking at Trainwreck Green here, and you better check yourself, old woman. Why am I not surprised by this?
Well, this is just where the Republican Party is. I mean, there's a saying in politics that if only every voter could meet my candidate, he'd win in a landslide. The opposite is true for Marjorie Taylor Greene. The more voters meet her, the more they go home thinking, I'm never going to vote for this person. How do I defeat this person? And it's such a double standard to me, I think, that Madison Cawthorn is really getting hammered now and called an embarrassment by the party. But everything Marjorie Taylor Greene is doing gets the thumbs up from Kevin McCarthy. It's all great.
Yeah, I mean, it's just crazy. And you know, look, she's not even the worst one. I mean, Boebert was, what was she going on about someone sending baby formula to China? I mean, just pulling stuff out of some orifice. It's kind of crazy.
I think she was accusing Congressman Eric Swalwell of sending our formula to Chinese babies. You know, your classic Lauren Boebert.
I mean, it's just plain kind of crazy, the stuff that goes on with these folks. And then it takes us over to Madison Cawthorn, where, wow, you want to talk about cratering. You want to talk about somebody who's literally, you know, tanking. Wow.
Yeah, I wish Democrats were this effective at attacking Republicans as Republicans are at attacking their own. There's an article out now in Politico about Madison Cawthorn is essentially detailing his collapse. And if the kid wasn't a Nazi, I would feel bad. It appears that he does have some real problems going on. There are several Republicans who spoke on the record in that piece that Madison Cawthorn needs help, maybe needs an intervention. And it left me feeling like I understood Madison Cawthorn better and also understood more than ever why he should be nowhere near a seat in Congress.
No, I said the same thing. I mean, there's somebody, look, I don't know what his orientation is, but clearly he's struggling with some identity issues, doing the cross-dressing thing, rubbing, shoving whatever in someone's face. There's a lot of questionable behavior going on there.
Yeah, I mean, bring a gun on a plane once, shame on you. Bring a gun on a plane twice, shame on me. It really is the detail, the number of things that have happened to him. Just in the past few months, another driving infraction that he's in court for, a marriage that dissolved. He's increasingly sort of erratic and lashing out even within his own party. It does make you think that the party is almost in a way doing him a favor by trying to push him out next week. And the scary thing is he might still win.
Yeah, that's the thing that gets me. I'm looking at the polls. He's still ahead. So what do they do once he wins? I mean,
I've seen some stories they're going to try and, you know, ostracize him a bit. But how do you do it that even more now that he's let it out of the bag? Because this all comes out, if you remember, all because he let it out of the bag about the coke and the orgies.
Yeah, and it's the same with Matt Gaetz. I mean, if Republicans take back the House, they're in sort of a moral pickle. Not that they're worried about the morals of it. Of if you say don't seat Madison Cawthorn because the entire party has condemned him, his entire state delegation has condemned him, how do you justify not seating Cawthorn but seating Marjorie Taylor Greene or seating Jim Jordan? This is a real question. There's so much rot that has gone untouched in the Republican Party that I'm just curious why Madison Cawthorn was the straw that broke the camel's back here.
I'm telling you, it was the coke and the orgies. You, it's like Fight Club. You can't talk about coke and orgy club. You just can't talk about it. It doesn't exist.
And people should stop. It is a terrible visual. You could envision any of the Republican caucus at a cocaine orgy. It you won't sleep.
Yeah, Chuck Grassley. You just can't imagine Chuck Grassley at the coke and orgy party. They can't get that out of you.
I can now. Thank you.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Max Burns. Max is a Democratic strategist, columnist over at the Daily Beast, and the newest on-camera correspondent with the Young Turks. You want to check out his work at the Daily Beast. We'll get links out on social media on how the work that he does there. I wanted to get your thoughts on this week. The president laid into Republicans for not being helpful. You're looking at the Rick Scott plan, kind of putting some blame at their feet, and then using the MAGA and ultra MAGA labels, which you knew immediately that the right was going to, going to take for their own. And I loved the Rick Wilson frame of this is another example of Democrats playing chess and Republicans eating the pieces, which I thought was brilliant because it's true. This is what they do. Thoughts?
I think from a messaging standpoint, this is a mess to me. This idea of ultra MAGA that comes at a time when there's sort of a civil war in the MAGA movement right now. We saw in Ohio, it's happening in Pennsylvania, right, as we speak. For these factions of the Trump movement to lay claim to who is the true sort of ideological heir. And having that ultra MAGA label essentially legitimizes that movement, offers them a way to legitimize themselves. And calling Donald Trump King MAGA, I think we should try to avoid branding our opponents with names they would use on themselves.
Exactly.
That will immediately be used for fundraising. And it just shows you that the communications apparatus in the party is still stuck in D.C. looking at consultant reports. They're not aware of how these things are being used on social media or how political language is evolving. They're just not in that conversation.
Yeah, and yesterday I started the show off with a quote from Paul Begala, who said that I don't know how the Democrats came from the party of the person on the factory floor to the party of the person in the factory lounge, but that's where he says we are. And I'm going, where you been? That's been that way for quite some time. And I would argue, Paul, you were part of what pushed us in that direction. But now that we identify, it's like any problem. Now that you understand what the problem is, change that. And this is where I wanted the president to lean heavily into. And he has. Look, I give him credit. He's leaned heavily into the union organizing, had Chris Smalls and a lot of the union organizers to the White House, has been very pro-labor. But I think you got to go even further than where we are. And you've got to start pushing Democrats up and down the ticket to be doing the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, we've really lost that labor core in the party. There was a point, I think, around the Obama 2008, 2012, where the party really started chasing Silicon Valley money. And there was a lot of young liberal tech billionaires who wanted to support the party. And the party moved that direction and stopped talking as closely with labor and stopped collaborating as closely. And right now we're in the middle of a labor renaissance in this country. And it's driven almost entirely by young people. Kind of voters Democrats need. And there's not the level of support I had expected to see. I was glad to see Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren out on picket lines. I was glad to see Joe Biden mention it. But I mean, you're right. It is a back burner conversation right now.
No, but this goes back to Bill Clinton even. I mean, this goes back to,
I voted for him for one reason. He was going to pass strike replacement, and that didn't happen. But, you know, he was, you know, part of what moved us away with the DLC and, you know, being more business friendly, kind of, you know, third way kind of stuff. And that whole DLC thing, the Democratic Leadership Council folks, you know, they moved us into the Wall Street types and away from workers and brought us trade policies and all kinds of things that harmed workers. And look, Al Gore was no great friend of labor either. They were just less bad than the Republicans. And that's been the problem. They've been just less bad instead of the champions that working people need. So clearly, you know, people went where someone was fighting for whatever interest they've got now. And working people then kind of took on some of these cultural issues going, hey, if I'm going to get screwed at work, let's fight for something else. And that's, I think, how we got where we are today.
It's certainly a reason we saw that labor just sheathed off the party in 2016 in a way that I don't think the pollsters predicted, because quite frankly, the modeling and the consensus polling data points among consultants in the Beltway discounts labor and to our detriment. And the best thing that we can do is really connect with this movement that's going on right now, especially with Starbucks. I think there are powerful union organizing forces at play in this country right now, and they are there to be allied with. And they will remember if we do not.
What I love about what's going on at Starbucks and also look at Amazon with Chris Smalls and the Amazon labor union is not so much that they're organizing and they're winning NLRB elections. It's that they're actually building worker power. They're building, you know, really aggressive workers who are demanding. They're not going to take no for an answer. And yeah, the Amazon example at JFK 8 is a perfect example of this. These are people who won't be denied. These are worker organizers who are fighting and internalize that worker power. And I keep saying this is what we need to go back to, because once you feel power in the workplace, that kind of sentiment goes into every other aspect of your life, political, social, all of that. And that's where I think we need to get back to.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we have the victories. What's missing are the visuals. This is a movement in dire need of some heroic and powerful visuals. I saw Starbucks had asked the White House to give them a meeting because the White House had met with union organizers. And I think that would be an incredible opportunity for Joe Biden to meet with Starbucks management and unions together in the treaty room and hold a Theodore Roosevelt style negotiation together.
Absolutely. But here's the interesting part of this. And, going back to the Clintons, we find out, and I remembered that Howard Schultz, the CEO, the old new CEO of Starbucks, was going to be Hillary Clinton's Secretary of Labor if she were elected in 2016. That shows how far the Democratic Party has moved back to the side of working people. And this is where I give Biden credit, and I hope he'll do just what you said. He'll convene a summit. Bring Howard Schultz and the Starbucks United folks together and have a rose garden and tea or whatever you got to do, have a coffee and hammer it out.
Yeah. I think that's an incredible visual would be Joe Biden just saying, we're going to the treaty room. We're not coming out until we have a deal. And the visual itself would be stunning. It would be an incredible show of progressivism in action, yielding results. I don't know why we've been so cautious about embracing this.
Yeah, I'm with you. Last question I got for you. Jen Psaki's leaving. I guess today, the last day. Evidently, she has held more press conferences than the entire 4 years of the former guy and all of his press secretaries, of which he had four: Spicer, Huckabee, Sanders, Grisham, and that Kayleigh McEnany. Wasn't Scaramucci, wasn't he one for about six? No, wait a minute. He was director of communications. I forgot that.
It was something, all right.
No, he was only there for a cup of tea. I mean, he wasn't there long. Like, what was it, like 10 minutes? He got his 15 minutes before they ushered him out. But you know, I think she'll be missed. I liked her. I liked her a lot.
Yeah, I liked her a lot. I mean, it's no surprise she did more work than all the Trump secretaries put together. That's what happens. you have someone who reads the training manual, who shows up to work and cares about the job. And I'm excited about Corinne Jean-Pierre as well. I mean, she's an incredibly talented communicator, a progressive communicator I have great respect for. I've seen her work up close. And I think she will be an excellent advocate for a White House that really needs a communication.
Are you surprised that the right's gone after her for comments trying to pin the racist label on her?
Not at all. Corinne Jean-Pierre is a Columbia-educated, gay, Haitian immigrant woman. This is everything that Republicans hate. She defies all of their ignorant stereotypes and excels so plainly that it enrages them. And this is sadly typical. It's disgraceful, but typical.
Yeah. Look, I know she's qualified. I know she's going to be great at her job, but there's part of me that goes, I got to think someone said this would be the perfect choice just to stick it to them a little bit. I mean, or am I just being a little cynical?
No, I think she was chosen entirely because she's excellent for the role. I think it certainly makes me happy that it makes Republicans upset.
Well, there is that. But just as a reminder, Stephanie Grisham held the title for 8 months of press secretary and did not hold one single on-the-record press briefing.
She'll be missed.
There you go. You will be. She's missed. All right. But Max, I appreciate the time. Again, congrats on the new gig. I hope you'll come back again and share some time with us since you've now hit the big time. Good on you, buddy.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, our good friend Max Burns. Make sure you check out his work at the Daily Beast. We'll get links out on social media how you can do that. Take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. 1-866-416-RICK. 1-866-416-7425. If you're just joining us, make sure you grab the podcast. Never miss an episode. Subscribe so it's always there, ready for you when you wake up. You take on the go. Back after this. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1968. That was the day that workers across Paris joined students in a citywide general strike. College students had begun an occupation at the famed Sorbonne University earlier that May. These students were protesting what they saw as governmental repression in post-war France. A story by NPR, marking the 40th anniversary of the protests, described the situation in France, where women could not wear pants to work and married ones needed a husband's permission to open a bank account. Homosexuality was a crime. Factory workers could be fired at will. The news on the single TV channel required governmental approval. And the overcrowded education system was authoritarian. The students protested French leader Charles de Gaulle and the police. The addition of workers to the protest greatly increased its scope and impact. Paris and much of the country ground to a halt. President de Gaulle was able to weather the protests and keep his political power. By the end of June, most workers had returned to their jobs, but the country would never be the same. The protests of that spring became known as the Social Revolution. It was a turning point in the nation's history, and institutions from workplaces to universities would undergo a liberalization due to the protests. One of the most lasting images from the strike was a series of posters, simple designs emblazoned with the slogans and demands of those involved. One such poster called people to strike, declaring, "Working now is working with a gun to your head." Another read simply, "Factories, universities, union." Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So I had one of these moments, during the break, my wife's telling me, Sarah from Chicago calls, listen on WCPT AM 820 going, I don't want to talk to somebody famous. I'm going, I'm famous? Oh my goodness. Someone thinks I'm famous. Oh, I'm not famous. I'm literally nobody. But hey, thank you, Sarah. I appreciate it. But Sarah did relay, you know, some interesting stuff to my wife, who does my screening. And it's the kind of stories that we do need to tell. They're important stories of, you know, kind of like I tell about my life. You know, when someone gets a union job in my neighborhood where I grew up in the projects, their life got better. And in those places where workers don't have that protection, life doesn't. And the story that, you know, Sarah was telling my wife was, you know, there was a black union and a white union. And back, you know, they were talking years and years ago. But, you know, you saw black workers have better lives because of their unions. And as she pointed out, you know, there was a worker who worked in the coal mines, didn't have protections of a union, ended up with black lung and ended up with nothing. Not surprising to me. But these are the stories that we have to tell. This is the history that we have to pass on from generation to generation to know where we've come from and where the right wing wants to take us back to. Because understand, when they talk about deregulation, they want to strip away protections that would save someone from black lung. When they talk about, you know, freedom of contract, they're talking about taking us back to the Lochner era where unions were bad, and bringing back yellow dog contracts where if you had the audacity to say you joined a union, you got fired immediately. These are stories we have to tell. So, Sarah, I appreciate it. I wish you to spend some time telling me your story, though. Let's quick go to the phones. Got Alice on line one. Alice, how are you today?
I'm good. I got two quick stories for you. First one, talking to the right-wing Trump supporter today, we got on the religion thing, and she was saying, going on and on about, well, you know, Jefferson wrote it, and he was a big Christian. Well, I had to bust her bubble and tell her, no, I think you need to research this a bit more. He was an atheist. He even took everything, published his own Bible.
Yeah, he wrote the Bible.
Yeah. Well, he took everything out of the, you know, King James thing on the New Testament, all the other stuff, and you know, put it together. And it actually, for years, and I think the last one was given out in the early 1900s, they would give them to the new Congress people when they come in. Okay, well, I busted her bubble on that, so, you know. And then I also informed her about Project Veritas was nothing more than the right-wing National Enquirer version. So she wasn't real happy. And then the second thing was, I'm minding my own business, got everything pulled out of the living room, vacuumed behind, phone's ringing off the hook, about killed myself to get to the phone to find out it was one of our right-wing people that are running for political office in Pennsylvania that was having the anti-abortion whatever wing of it calling to save the unborn babies and donate to him. Yeah, well, they weren't real happy by the time I got off the phone with them.
I'm sure you donated something.
I gave them information, if nothing else. They hung up on me.
Yeah, I can see that happening.
Yeah, so, yeah, but hey, when I hit my toe, you know, I'm not being nice to anybody. So you have a good evening.
Thank you, Alice. I appreciate it. I would have loved to have been I would have loved to have heard that conversation. Can we record that? That would have been radio gold. But you know, at the end of it, look, this is why I think what we do here is so important. Having these conversations, talking about how we move in a more positive direction and do things that are going to make lives better. I think that's important. And what we're not getting from our Republican friends. And look, you know, as we're seeing, they don't have a policy agenda. There's nothing there. There's lots of insanity. There's lots of circus acts. There's lots of grievance. There's lots of outrage candy. But there's no policy on what exactly are you going to do to make our lives better? What are you going to do to take on and fix inflation other than platitudes? You know, I have a lot of friends who go, you know, Joe Biden did this. Well, how did he do it? Well, he gave $1,400 to everyone. Well, Biden gave $1,400, but Trump gave $1,800. So what's your point? Well, he gave a bunch of money to the states. Yeah, he gave money to the states. Like DeSantis has got money from the federal government that he's using to give tax breaks to the people of Florida, like DeWine's did in Ohio.
like Kristi Noem did in South Dakota. What's your point? But they don't get that. They don't get that. While all of these Republican politicians are bashing Biden, they took the money. They took all of it. Didn't vote for it. Attempted to block every bit of it. But boy, did they take it. Boy, did they line their pockets. And this is where, you know, again, understanding exactly what these people are about, why it's so vitally important to ask the question, what are you going to do? And if they don't have an answer, you don't vote for them. If their answer is, well, I'm not them, that ain't a good answer. Just throwing that out. Anyway, if you've missed any of today's program, make sure you grab the podcast, therickssmithshow.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. For stations picking up only the first hour, make sure you get that second hour at the podcast. For everybody else, we're going to take a quick break right back after this.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I love the fact that I got an email today, and this is one of those moments that just kind of grabs your attention and goes, where exactly have you been for the last, the subject line of the email was, overturning Roe is not a single issue, but the first step to far worse. I'm going, is this really the first step? I would argue first step happened a long time ago. If you look at what our Supreme Court's been doing for the last, about 22 years, bad decisions for quite some time. This just the next in what I argue going to be several more down the line. But this is a big one, not diminishing, big one, but just the next in the class war that another segment of the population going to be harmed by. And this is why I keep saying every time this comes up, whether it was voting rights, whether it was workers' rights, whether it was consumer rights, not women's rights, if it hasn't hit you yet, it's coming. So how about we fight now to stop this from getting any worse? And here to share some thoughts on, well, how horrible this fight is and why we should be fighting this one now so that maybe we don't have to worry about the ones down the road. I've asked Elisa Spitzer to come talk with us. She is a policy analyst with the Women's Initiative at the Center for American Progress. AmericanProgress.org is their website. Elisa, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you for having me.
So, you know, I see this email today, and I got to tell you, maybe I'm wrong. Am I wrong on this? That, look, there are some who are going, oh, my God, I can't believe this just happened. This is so huge. It is big. It is a big thing, but it's another one of these death of a thousand paper cuts, another movement towards a repeal of the 20th century and all the progress that generations before us fought for. It is a big one. It is not the big one, but I'm curious your thoughts.
So I think that the death of a thousand paper cuts is unfortunately apt. Since Roe was decided in 1973, there have been, I believe it's 1,338 state restrictions that have been passed. In some way limiting abortion access, trap laws, or variety of approaches. But this has been an item on the to-do list for people who oppose abortion access and full equality for women for a very, very, very long time. And so it is, for people who have been watching quite closely, not necessarily a surprise, particularly with the most recent appointments to the bench, but it is still stunning to see it in writing, which we all did, of course, in the leaked draft opinion.
But Susan Collins said that they weren't going to do this. She looked into their souls. They promised her this wasn't going to happen. At least I thought we had some assurance that wasn't going to happen because stare decisis, balls and strikes, or am I missing something?
No, you're not. I mean, Roe has been the law for just a year shy of 50 years. It has been in place for generations. When people think about what it was like before Roe, you know, I at least am thinking about my grandmother and great grandmother. You're right to think that this was settled law. People were right to take that for granted. And now I think we might be entering a new era.
What do you say to the people? And I've had conversations with younger women who don't see this as kind of a hair on fire moment. And maybe this is a good thing. Maybe the younger generation feels more empowered than the older generation, with some of the women that I've talked to who see this as a real tragedy and a real, you know, infringement on rights of future women and all of this. But what do you say to a younger generation that feels, you know, we're not going backward. You're not going to take my rights away, even though the law is changing. What do you say to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the Supreme Court's jurisprudence can seem somewhat abstract. You know, it seems like there's a distance between what they put down on paper and what actually reaches you personally and in the depths of your private decisions and how you understand your future. I think I would just point them to state trigger laws and the state laws that will go to effect. It is expected that somewhere between 26 and up to 28 states are poised, like standing at the ready, to outlaw abortion when and if, we say if because it hasn't happened yet, the Supreme Court decides to overturn Roe. And, you know, it's unfortunate if it doesn't feel real until it's real.
Yeah.
But it likely will soon be real.
Now, you couch that in terms of, you know, maybe there's a possibility, because I keep hearing this as well. Don't get too upset. This could all change. This was a first draft, which is why, again, I think it was leaked when it was leaked. And I have a theory. I think it was a certain Supreme Court justice's wife that did it. Just my personal opinion. I have no factual basis to make that, other than maybe there was a time in the past where this may have happened, where something was leaked, but just kind of spitballing here a little bit. But it's my thought that they put this out there knowing that there's almost no way the Supreme Court can now walk back from this. They've set the goalpost. But do you think there's a way they can soften this and walk it back at this point?
So I think that technically they can do whatever they want at this point. They are in no way legally bound or committed to anything in this draft. This was a first draft, and an early draft at very least. And I've had early drafts that look quite different from where things end up. So this is the optimist in me you are hearing. I am quite nervous. I do not really think there is much space for hope. I think that there definitely, this could be made less bad on the margins. Right now, the way the draft is written, it very directly calls into question contraception and gay rights and sort of precedents that we really wanted not to touch.
And yeah, basically a repeal of the 20th century, which I've been saying for about 17 years of doing this program, that this has been the conservative wet dream for a very long time, to undo all of the 20th century and return us to the good old days of the 80s and 90s and not the 1980s and 90s.
Right. It is definitely a jurisprudence of a different era and a different century. So I think that I am not terribly optimistic, but I do think that there are conversations and negotiations that very well could have happened between February 10th, which is the date on the leaked draft, and the present, that maybe will make it less harmful in sort of other doctrinal ways. But I think in terms of the effect on limiting abortion access, the people who will be directly hurt and forced to carry pregnancies to term, whose job prospects and graduation rates and ability to determine the course of their own lives, I think that will be real.
You listen to the Rick Smith Show here with Elisa Spitzer. She is the policy analyst over at the Center for American Progress, where she specializes in women's initiative. You can check out their website, AmericanProgress.org. We'll get links out on social media, how you can take a look at the work that they do. You know, this is one of those things where, you know, again, you know, people are pointing, saying, well, you know, I don't see the outrage. You know, there were a handful of people out at Kavanaugh's house. There was the rumor that Alito had gone down into whatever, some special bunker. I don't know. The Senate immediately jumped into action in the most bipartisan of terms to get special policing powers for our justices, who nobody thought was in any real danger. But, you know, hey, we had to act because you crazy women can't be trusted, evidently, to, you know, protest peacefully. And Susan Collins called the police on you, too, for putting chalk on her sidewalk, which bad chalk.
Meanwhile, abortion protesters are actually endangering people who are just trying to go to their appointments at the clinic and threatening providers and providers' families. And there is a security issue, but it doesn't, at least from what I'm aware of, seem to be primarily targeted for.
And this is where I was going with this, because, you know, for decades now, we've had right-wing zealots who are blowing up clinics, who are threatening people. Where was this kind of bipartisanship to protect people, actual we the people, instead of our elites back then? And this is where I struggle with all of the things, the attacks that are happening to the working class of this country. And I focus solely on the working class, and you can agree or disagree with me, because I believe that this decision will kill poor and working class women. This isn't going to affect rich women. They're going to get what they need, even if they have to leave the country to do it. They're going to have the access that they want and need, regardless, because they're going to have the resources to do it. This is going to focus heavily on poor and working class women and families, which is, again, I think part of the reason why they're doing it.
Yes, I agree with you. I think that it is just factually true that traveling, so because abortion will be unavailable in likely over half of the states, it means that people in those states will have to travel in order to obtain the health care that they need. Traveling is very expensive. Traveling is not something you can do if you can't afford childcare, if you can't afford to take time off of work, if you can't pay for the expense of abortion, which, you know, is difficult to get coverage of. It is really an economic justice issue, absolutely.
And the other part of this, the scarier part of this, is with the technology that we've seen that's already, you know, just available to anybody almost, you can find who's going where. My fear, and this is where this gets even worse for me, you look at the Texas law, the bounty hunter stuff. Do we turn, you know, hunting women and their bodies into a reality show? Is this the next Dog the Bounty Hunter thing? Is this the next money-making venture for people to hunt down you and women across this country who, you know, look at the case in Texas where the woman had a miscarriage and immediately they rush in to try and charge her with a crime? Is this the direction that things are starting to go? Not just where we're taking your right to self-determination and your health care away, but also going to that next level of persecution, prosecution, just to make points. I and also us really ratting out each other and creating even more, I don't know what the right word is, even more harassment of women in all different facets. Or am I just reading too much into this?
The threat of criminalization is very real. It used to be that in abortion prohibitions, prosecuting the person seeking care was anathema. That was not done. However, frighteningly, that might be changing. Louisiana had a statute that I believe today was actually just withdrawn, but it had been voted out of committee and actually was being discussed on the floor of the House that would have changed the definition of personhood for purposes of their criminal statute to include a fertilized egg, meaning that certain forms of contraception and abortion would actually have been qualified as murder and could have been punished as such. So fortunately, that is not on the path to becoming law, but it is absurd and it is horrifying. And sort of unimaginable things are actually under discussion.
Do you find it as bizarre as I do, the fact that there are people who are pushing to repeal this, force women to have children, and then are giving no help whatsoever that once the child is born, we're going to actually care for them. We're going to actually get, you know, women the prenatal care. Because as I understand, and obviously you're probably much more better versed at this than I am,
But when you're talking about poor women, you know, in prenatal care and death in this country, we're almost a third world nation. When you're talking about women in poverty dying in this country during childbirth. And yet I don't see the Republicans and the people who are pushing this stuff moving any type of policy to change that, to get early childhood care, to get, you know, maternity leave, to get, you know, education, to get health care, to get, you know, food assistance. I see Marjorie Traitor Greene out there yelling about formula, but I don't see any legislation to help try and get any more formula out of her other than just grievance and finger painting and outrage candy. Yet here are these people, no policy aims to help once the child come, once we pop something out. And I find that very, very odd and very interesting.
It is true that the United States has horrific maternal mortality rates and that our supports for parents and caregivers, young children, families really are paltry as compared to equivalent countries. You know, paid leave shouldn't have been so contentious. It's phenomenal that we don't have it. Totally agree with you.
No, because here's where my thoughts are. And look, I'm just an old white guy. You know, my childbearing years well behind me. Not that I ever had any, but I would think, and again, I'm just speaking, you know, hypothetically, because I don't actually, I've never been in the position. My wife has had three children. We've got three kids. We wanted them. We planned them. You know, we were prepared for them. We you know, all that. It seems to me that if you have an environment that is conducive for people to bring children in, where you're going to have the health care that they need, it's going to be much more welcoming. They're going to get education. You're going to have jobs that are going to be able to support them. You're going to have safe neighborhoods and housing that's affordable, where you're going to have an environment that's conducive to raising children and supporting families, that's going to be much more conducive to people wanting to have children and not have abortions than saying you must. And oh, I don't know, maybe some policy, again, I'm a policy guy, saying, you know what, maybe we want to make sure that people get contraception. Maybe we want to make sure we do some education. Instead, what we get is idiotic head in the sand, abstinence only nonsense. We're going after contraception, which again, I guess that's on the table now after, you know, 50 plus odd years. And policies just literally take food out of the mouths of children. And I'm going, what kind of insanity is this? How are we encouraging people to have children in this kind of environment? Again, I ask, or am I missing something?
You are not missing anything. I think it's important that even if there were all of those supports, that should be the baseline. And then people should be free to make the decision about whether they personally want with their body to have children, if they want in the course of their life to have children. It is an enormous commitment. I speak from experience. And, but it is the idea that we are going to be in a situation where people are forced to give birth without those supports is especially cruel.
Yeah. And we're going to put women in desperate situations, which again, you know, I look, there's a political ideology that wants working class people desperate. They want them pliable. You know, we're moving back toward the Lochner era of wages and hours and conditions. And back, like I said, back to the good old days of the 80s and 90s and not the 1980s and 90s. Last question I've got for you. Here's my problem. I'm not seeing the kind of outrage. And again, we can go back to every one of these death of 1,000 paper cuts where it was the attack on voting rights, consumer rights, workers' rights, all of this. The outrage that I would hope to see, I don't think I'm seeing yet. Are we going to see it? Are you seeing it? Because I think there are people who are going, well, it must not be that big of a deal. Not seeing much outrage. Thoughts?
I'm seeing outrage. I'm feeling outrage. I've been to protests. I know more are coming. And I think that the fact that this was a leaked opinion has sort of tempered it. I think the fact that a lot of us have been waiting for this day to come and fearing this day for a while, maybe is part of it, that it's sort of the shock of it hasn't, there isn't so much shock really. But yeah, I imagine you'll see some more.
Damn well better, because, you know, at the end of this, I look at our political leaders. They were such a big hurry to protect the Supreme Court justices. But, man, when it comes to protecting, like I said, consumers, workers, women, we'll see. I guess this is why elections matter, and why I hope voters go to the polls angry. And I hope you go in large numbers and throw bums out and bring people in who are going to have the passions of the people to bring back policy that's going to move us in a better direction. But, Elisa, I appreciate you taking some time, sharing your expertise, and I hope you'll come back and talk to us again real soon.
Thanks for having me.
Elisa Spitzer, policy analyst there at the Center for American Progress. Make sure you check out the work that they do at AmericanProgress.org. We'll get links out on social media how you can do that. Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Give us a call, 1-866-416-RICK, 1-866-416-7425. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, ricksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. If you don't, if you miss any of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Fairly important that we grab the podcast and move that right along. All good stuff. Let's go to the let's go to the phone lines. Got Gary on line one. Gary, how are we doing today?
I'm as frustrated and afraid as just about everybody.
Join the club. So, what's got you frustrated and afraid, brother?
Well, you asked a question just a few seconds ago, or actually, you made a statement. The statement was that you felt that you're not seeing the outrage. I'm just north of Philly, and I can tell you that I don't know anyone that isn't outraged except for those who are on the right now.
Good.
I haven't met a soul. There is not a single person I've talked to that I hang out with that is not terrified of what's occurring, and I'm very clear that we are, we're angry, we're frustrated, and we're terrified. And I'm also speaking partially as a Jewish person. These guys want to make America a Christian nation. And when I was growing up, I'm 66 now, when I was growing up and going to Hebrew school, not long after the Holocaust, about 20 years, they were telling us that this can happen again. And to be aware of it. The Holocaust can happen again. In fact, it's still happening all over the world in one way or another. Genocide is clearly happening. The other thing that I actually did want to say is that you asked a question, or actually you made a statement. You said that you don't understand why Biden would start labeling folks as ultra-MAGA. And I don't think he's talking to the left. I actually think he's talking to the undecided, the folks that are still trying to figure out where they stand. And the right wing has been extraordinarily good at calling us radical liberal leftists. And I think this is his way of going in the other direction. Just kind of like Jamie Raskin has been really tearing into the person you call Marjorie Prater Greene.
Right.
So, I think there's lots of interesting things that are going on. I'm not certain that we're in the clear. I'm absolutely certain that we're not. But I'm really hoping that the left becomes far more aggressive in terms of their labeling for the middle of the road.
I'm right there with you, Gary. I appreciate
That's all
the call,
I got to
man.
Say.
Thanks so much. Please call back again. I appreciate it. I got to take a quick break here. I'm with you. I'm glad to hear there is outrage. Quick break. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I got to tell you, I'm thrilled to hear Gary, say that, that people are outraged. I'm glad to hear that there's that emotion out there, that there's that fire out there, that people are aware. I'm thrilled to hear it, and I think we should be hearing more of it. I think there should be more. I think people should be outraged. At least, that is my hope. Let's go to the phone lines and see. We got Julie on line two. Julie, how are we doing today?
Hi, Rick. You know, it might have something to do with the people you know, but I don't know anybody that's not outraged either. But what I wanted to comment on was I hear a lot of people saying, well, if they're really pro-life, they would want to provide education for these babies. They would want to provide health care. They would want to help with food. The whole idea, when you stop to think about it, is they want poor women, let's get real. They want poor white women to feel hopelessly pressured to give up their babies and give them to the far right. I mean, handmaiden gal on the Supreme Court, she says, adoption, adoption. And they have the structure in place and to do it. And the adoption agencies and working with the church, they have a baby lust for white babies. Let's get real. What do you think about that?
No, I don't disagree with that. But the problem is, having grown up where I grew up in a housing project, a minority in a minority community, I saw poverty firsthand. And if you're going to force single mothers to have children, there's got to be a way to ensure that the kind of suffering and violence and inhumanity that I saw growing up doesn't happen. And
well, yeah, that's the moral thing to do. That's the compassionate thing to do. That's if you've got warm blood running in your veins and not if you have some kind of cold reptilian soul. But I'm saying, let's be honest, the other side seems to have a cold reptilian soul, and you're right. And I feel the same way. If you're going to force poor women to have children, society has a responsibility. But the other side that is in power with the Supreme Court and everything, that's what they are about, and that's what we're up against. You know what I'm saying?
I completely understand, and I hear you, Julie. And I tell you, I'm thrilled to hear people are outraged, because I'll tell you, the conversations I'm having with people, I'm hearing, younger women saying, no, we'll work around it. They're not going to take my rights away. There's this idea that it's not going to be as bad as I believe it's going to be, because I think this is, again,
I wish they were right. I would love to be wrong, wouldn't you?
Absolutely. I sure do. But Julie, I appreciate the call. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Seriously, I'm happy to hear people, and I want people to be outraged. I want people calling their representatives. I want people being fired up, talking to their neighbors. I want people committing to voting. I want people committing to throwing the bums out. This is what we should be doing. And the Democrats had better get their heads out of the sand and start leading the charge and stoking this outrage and getting out in front of this, at least my thoughts. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on top stories of the day, our good friend, former Ohio congressman and political analyst, Bob Ney. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thank you, Rick.
I'm sorry I had to grab a couple of calls that I think, I've been saying I haven't seen the outrage that I would hope that I would be seeing. Maybe I'm starting to see it. Maybe people are outraged, and I'm just not seeing in this moment. I'm curious, as this leak of the Supreme Court decision has been out, are you seeing the kind of outrage that you would think that you would have seen in this moment?
No, not in mass. Now, I'm not saying that, people are obviously upset about this, and people are speaking out, and there's been some protests. So I'm not saying that there hasn't been a reaction. But as far as, listening to people, which I do, I've got friends all over the country, and hearing, this issue come up first, no, I don't in a lot of cases. So I don't think it's to the level, that it may get to, Rick, as the time nears closer.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thrilled to hear people are taking this serious. I also wanted to get your thoughts on Rand Paul yesterday blocking the Ukrainian aid I'm trying to figure out the sense of this. I know he said, you know, it's my oath of office. It's to the Constitution, not to a foreign nation. And I'm going, is this the fight you want to make?
No, it's not. Now, you know the history of Rand Paul, how he has done this before. Not on the Ukraine, of course, but on other issues. He's done it on a budget issue, then he holds it up, and then he releases it. But he blocked this bipartisan effort, which is absolutely amazing that he did that. I just don't understand what he gets out of it or what point he makes on it.
Yeah, I'm not understanding where a lot of the Republicans are in this moment. I mean, you saw, you know Marjorie, you know, Greene, you know, going on about, you know, how we're going to give them $40 billion, but we're not doing anything on baby formula. We see some of the statements that are coming out, and you go, how are those connected, especially since you don't have a bill to do anything on baby formula? Put something out. I want to see something.
Right. Now, McConnell and Schumer did offer to allow a vote on Ron Paul's amendment, but he insisted it would be added to the underlying bill. So they said, you know, okay, we'll give you a vote, you know, on an amendment he had, and it would have made his amendment is to make a special inspector general to oversee how the Ukraine military aid is spent. So they said, well, okay, we'll give you a vote on it, but that wasn't enough for him. He wanted it in the underlying measure of the bill, and he held the bill up. It's quite amazing. I understand he does this accountability thing. He's done it before on issues, but on this one, I think it's pretty clear where the money's going to go.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Pretty clear.
Now I got to get your thoughts on yesterday's big news of the subpoenas that went out to Kevin McCarthy, to Jim Jordan, the Ohio representative, to my congressman, Scott Perry, Andy Biggs of Arizona, and Mo Brooks of Alabama. I don't think anybody thinks that they're going to testify. I don't think anyone thinks the subpoenas are going to bring them in. You think this was a smart move to subpoena them?
Well, what is going to happen, of course, is that the Republicans then are going to, if they take control, are going to say, okay, we're going to subpoena certain members to ask them, you know, certain things. So it'll be a sort of a precedent-setting payback, I guess you could say. And they've made that argument. Beyond listening to that argument about who's going to control the chamber or not and what they're going to do, which, let's take a broader brush on that, Rick. There's a lot of, you know, if the Republicans control the chamber, are they going to do other things beyond subpoena Democrat members? But
they're going to. I mean, you know, if you saw the polling out today,
for other things,
the polling out today is that, you know, a large majority of Republicans want to impeach Joe Biden, and you go, for what?
Right. So, you know, they made that statement. But as far as the issue itself, I don't think that it's going to go anywhere. It makes a fight now between the Democrats and the Republicans about complying with the subpoena or not, and then that will be an issue that will drag on. I don't know how you in an emergency basis alleviate that in court to say, McCarthy, you're going to testify. I highly doubt that happens. So it'll be just an argument back and forth between the committee and McCarthy. I just don't see it going anywhere.
Yeah, and look, if they don't testify, if you're right and Republicans take control, this will be Democrats going, well, you didn't testify, we're not going to either. So
right.
it'll set a precedent
right
there. But I'm still in the position of, if it's you, if it's me, if it's anybody else, they subpoena us, someone sits our butt in that chair. And
right,
the fact that they are our representatives, that what they did was in our name, I got to tell you, I think that should supersede all of that. That I think we have a right to know what they were doing in our name. That I'm sorry, you've got rights, absolutely, as an individual, and you got rights to not incriminate yourself, but you are our representative. There should be more transparency on you than the average citizen. Or am I just being me?
Well, no, it's it's not equal application under the law. I used examples when the insurrection came about. If you and I broke a post office window, it's going to be pretty clear-cut destruction of federal property. So, you know, but all of a sudden, it was selfies, and they, you know, and let's give them a break, et cetera, when they, you know, stormed the Capitol. It's the same thing here. It's not the same application for the regular citizen. If we, you and I, get subpoenaed by a county prosecutor, guess what? It's going to have force and authority to it. And this is the congressional level. So there's not equal application under the law when it comes to these members.
Yeah, it's well, we're
at all.
We are definitely in interesting times. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Bob Ney, former Ohio congressman, political analyst. You know, I wanted to get your thoughts on the NATO stuff that's going on. Finland, Sweden, now talking about, you know, they're going to be moving towards NATO. We've had these conversations before that, you know, there are some who believe that, you know, the expansion of NATO was, you know, something that shouldn't have happened after the fall of the wall. Some people have told me, well, you know, we promised that we would never do that. I can't seem to find where George H.W. Bush made that promise. But I'm curious your thoughts. Is this a good idea, bad idea? Where do you see this going?
Well, I think for Finland to make that decision was a good idea. And Sweden, who has had a 200-year history of not making a decision to be a part of anything, is now leaning, you know, towards that direction. And this is all due to Vladimir Putin and his actions in the Ukraine. Now, what really amazes me is that the Russian defense minister, once again, when he talks about Finland coming into NATO, uses the word nuclear. You know, what do they think? Finland's going to attack Russia, and they're going to have to launch nuclear weapons? I mean, Russia's boldness of aggression is beyond comprehension. I think for Finland's purposes, it's good that it will go into NATO for some form of official protection. If the Ukraine was part of NATO, there would have been a flyby, or, you know, blocking the Russians with the flyovers would have happened. So I think Finland going in is a good thing. Russia, of course, if it's saying that, oh, well, this type of thing could lead to the use of nuclear weapons, well, is that because they have an intention someday to invade Finland? Is that what's out there? I mean, I just don't trust the Russians, period, on this.
Yeah, I don't trust Putin at all. And
at
this
all.
This is you know, him devolving. And now we hear that, I guess, Lloyd Austin's had some conversations with some top Russian diplomats. Is this going to lead us in any direction? Hopefully. Do you see an end to this? I mean, because this is where I'm going, where does this end? Because, you know, the atrocities that we're seeing, in fact, there's a Russian soldier, as we speak, being on a 21-year-old kid on trial for shooting a 62-year-old man in the head while he was riding his bike unarmed. And you're going to hear all of these horrible tragedies and all of these things that are going to come up. But, you know, there's got to be some way, there's got to be an end to this.
I think the only way that potentially it will come to where you have some type of solution is for people like Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin to speak with his counterparts, and then ideas come forth from those counterparts to each other. It's not going to happen at the level of Putin. It's going to have to happen from some ideas, you know, from defense ministers in Russia and from, you know, our defense secretary, obviously. But do I think something's going to, you know, be thrown out on the table to go with it? I don't see it happening. I don't see it ending quick, because Russia now has put itself in its mind, through Putin's deranged mind, has put itself into a position of no way out. I mean, it doesn't seem that you can offer Russia anything. The White House indicated the other day they were looking for, you know, some, and they even said some ways out for Russia. And I don't know what you give Putin to satisfy his ego at this point in time. So I think it's going to continue on and on until hopefully enough armaments for the Ukrainians, or maybe there can be some type of stopping the, you know, the Russian air bombing, to at least at some point in time force some type type of agreement, you know, where, I don't know, Ukraine makes a statement about, you know, NATO that Putin wants. I thought originally that's what this was about, and it wasn't. It was about Putin being totally out of control.
Yeah, I mean, all of the things that he said this was about, it wasn't about.
It wasn't. It wasn't at all. I thought he was, I believe the world thought he was trying to get some type of compromise, some type of statement. It wasn't about that. It was about pure aggression, and he's convinced his people in Russia that if he doesn't do this, the West is going to march in and you know, take over Russia itself. He's convinced them of it. 83% of the people are supporting him. So you have a lunatic in control that has the population, for the most part, supporting what he's doing. So I don't see a quick way out.
There's literally no way back from this.
No, I don't see it.
Scary stuff. Last question I got for you. I'm looking at North Korea right now, and they're talking about potentially an explosion of COVID there. This could be the next global outbreak point. Evidently, 6 people have died and 350,000 have been treated for some kind of spread going on there. Not that we would know what's going on in North Korea, but there seems to be some concern. Any thoughts?
You know, it's the Hermit Kingdom, and with Kim Jong-un, you never know what really is going on there. Now, North Korea itself, of course, is officially saying that they're experiencing a massive outbreak of COVID with 350,000 cases. And that was just 24 hours after they claimed to have found the first ever case of COVID. So I don't know. I'm a bit skeptical that they find the first case of COVID and that within one day they have 350,000, you know, outbreak. Although he starved his population, they're in horrible abject poverty. So I guess anything would be possible. But you never, Rick, you just never know with information coming out of there. Remember when everybody thought he was dead, and you just don't know with Kim Jong-un.
Yeah, again, another lunatic.
Right.
The world, you know, being held hostage by another lunatic. Bob, I appreciate the time. As always, good stuff.
Thank you, Rick.
Our good friend Bob Name. Going to take a quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. If you've just joining us, make sure you grab the podcast. Never miss an episode. Subscribe, like, share, all of that stuff. Email rick@therickssmithshow.com. Right back after this. Stick around. Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. So interesting couple of days here in the state of Pennsylvania where I live. Our primary is coming up here in a couple of days, and the governor's race getting kind of interesting as the Pennsylvania State Senate President pro tempore Jake Corman yesterday suspended his campaign officially and endorsed the former congressman from my district, former Congressman Lou Beacon Teeth Barletta. If you've ever seen him, tanned, you know, like dark tan with these, you know, just beacon, giant chomper, glowing teeth. It's kind of scary when you see him walk down the street. They're like, you know, big chomper, like cartoon teeth almost. But today, former Congresswoman Melissa Hart, she followed suit. Because what's going on is the Republicans are freaking out by the fact that Doug Mastriano, the state senator, and, you know, January 6th leader, took a bunch of people down to the January 6th rally. And, you know, QAnon, really kind of far out, extreme, crazy, way out guy is kind of leading, and now the rumor is Trump is going to endorse him at any minute. This has got the Republican establishment here in the state kind of concerned, because Pennsylvania, we're going to find out just how crazy Pennsylvania is becoming, because, you know, the Republicans don't believe that Pennsylvania is this extreme of a state, and they fear that they're going to lose both the governor and the Senate race. Because their candidates are flipping nuts. And then the Senate side, you've got, you know, you got three of them that are, you got, you know, Dr. Oz, which is, you know, right up Trump's alley. You know, the guy who, you know, TV celebrity with, you know, very loose ideology, you know, whatever, ask him a question today, he'll change his mind tomorrow. You got this Dave McCormick, who, you know, wealthy investor, wealthy guy, you know, he's kind of more the traditional-ish Republican thought. And then this Kathy Barnett, who, you know, full on, you know, wild conspiracy, you know, regularly attacking gay people and Muslims and, you know, all kinds of stuff. And a little questionable with the truth. You know, for instance, it's one of those things where I guess she was asked if she voted in the 2016 election, because people ask questions when you're a candidate, and you probably shouldn't lie. But evidently, Kathy Barnett just couldn't not lie, and, you know, said that she voted, and then when asked again, doubled down and said she voted when voting records say that she didn't, that she didn't vote until 2018. And then voted 2018, 2020, and then 2021. And again, like I said, she was asked again, and absolutely doubled down. And again, about her military record, you know, said she was in the military. You know, she was a 10-year veteran. The records that she released evidently only show 8. And you go, well, you know, it's not that big. Yeah, big deal. Facts matter. She could win. It's kind of interesting. Now, we had Ted Cruz, who didn't bother going to Cancun this weekend, maybe got lost going to Cancun, came to Pennsylvania and said instead, you know, mocking Republicans for sucking up to Donald Trump. He was out pimping Dave McCormick, the Senate candidate. And why, again, Ted Cruz is here, I have no idea. But I found it interesting that he's now, after all of the things that he, all of the brown nosing or orange nosing, I guess, is a better way of putting it. That he did with Trump, he's now found some beer muscles. Going to be an interesting Tuesday here in Pennsylvania to see, you know, which way the state goes. Because for me, this is kind of that, going to be kind of the weather vane to see which way the wind's blowing in this state. And ultimately, which way the state goes in November. There's an opportunity for Democrats to pick up a couple of seats here, a governor's seat, hold on to, and pick up a Senate seat. There's a good opportunity here. Just a matter of how extreme is the Republican base right now? And how much does Roe hurt them in this state? Bob Casey came out and said he would support codifying Roe into law. That is a huge thing. That's why elections matter. That's why voting matters. That's why you've got to make sure wherever you are, make sure you're registered, make sure you commit to voting. Then we start throwing some of these bums out. If you missed any of today's program, therickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast, the Rick Smith Show app on the smartphone. Take the program on the go wherever you go. And as always, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator. You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.